W.E.B. Du Bois. More than any intellectual this nation produced in the 20th century, explained America to itself.
Notes from the Left Forum. The 2018 Left Forum was held in June at John Jay College in New York City. The theme, towards a new strategy for the left, work to build broad coalitions for freedom and justice in an effort to push reactionary demagogues back into obsolescence. In this program, the Left Forum looks at the work and legacy of William Edward Burghardt Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois, and what his life and work can teach us today. The panel was organized by Democracy at Work and the Left Forum. We hear first Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, activist, and Presbyterian minister, the author of several books, including War is the Force That Gives Us Meaning. He's a columnist for Truth Dig and host of the weekly radio program On Contact. Then economics professor and co-founder of Democracy at Work, Richard Wolff. We begin with Chris Hedges.
W.E.B. Du Bois. More than any intellectual this nation produced in the 20th century, explained America to itself. He did this not only through what he called the color line, but by exposing the intertwining of empire, capitalism, and white supremacy. He deftly fused academic disciplines. He possessed unwavering integrity, a deep commitment to the truth, and the courage to speak it. That he was brilliant and a radical was bad enough. That he was brilliant, radical, and black terrified the ruling elites. He was swiftly blacklisted, denied the professorships and public platforms that went to those who were more obsequious and compliant. Du Bois had very few intellectual rivals, John Dewey perhaps being one. But Dewey failed, like nearly all white intellectuals, to grasp the innate violence and savagery of the American character and how it was given its natural expression in empire. Regeneration and purification through violence is the credo of America. D.H. Lawrence, like Du Bois, saw it and said, "But the essential American soul is hard, isolate, stoic, and a killer. The pillars of American capitalism are genocide and slavery. America was not blessed by God. It was blessed, if that is the right word, by producing the most efficient killing machines and trained killers on the planet. It unleashed industrial violence on its enemies, abroad and empowered, armed white vigilante groups and gun thugs, the slave patrols, the Ku Klux Klan, the White Leagues, the armed wing of the Democratic Party, Baldwin Felts and Pinkertons, to perpetrate a domestic reign of terror against blacks, abolitionists, Catholics, radicals, workers, labor organizers, and Chinese. The ideological descendants of these killers have mutated into white hate groups and militarized law enforcement that terrorize immigrants and undocumented workers, Muslims, and people of color trapped in our internal colonies. This bloody visage is the true face of America." Once in a while, through all of us, there flashes some clairvoyance, some clear idea of what America really is, Du Bois wrote. "We who are dark can see America in a way that white Americans cannot." Du Bois warned that in times of widespread unrest, this indiscriminate violence, familiar to poor people of color and those we subjugate in the Middle East, becomes the primary mechanism for internal social control. As the empire disintegrates under unfettered corporate capitalism, feudal and costly military adventurism, political stagnation, and despotism, we will soon learn the truth, Du Bois elucidated. But I want to begin today by looking at one of his often overlooked essays, The Souls of White Folks, from his book Dark Water, Voices from Within the Veil. He wrote this essay in 1920. White Europeans and Americans were struggling to cope with the suicidal slaughter and barbarity of World War I. Yet, as Du Bois pointed out, none of this savagery was a surprise to blacks in the United States or the victims of colonialism. 10 to 12 million people died under the brutal colonial rule of the Belgian King Leopold in the Congo alone. It was Belgium, not the Congo, however, that was held up as the victim of horrible atrocities due to German occupation during the war. Behold little Belgium with her pitiful flight, but has the world forgotten Congo? Du Bois asked. Racism, he saw, was not only endemic to capitalism and imperialism, but to formed historical narratives, the stories that got told and those that did not. In the United States, the year before the essay was published, 66 black men and women, mostly in the rural South, were lynched. Another 250 died in urban riots, usually instigated by white vigilante mobs in the North and in the Arkansas Delta. They could have told you, if they were asked, what America was. As we saw the dead dimly through the rifts of battle smoke and heard faintly the cursings and accusations of blood brothers, we darker men said, this is not Europe gone mad. This is not an aberration nor insanity. This is Europe. This seeming terrible is the real soul of white culture, Du Bois wrote. Du Bois attended the Versailles Conference that imposed punitive reparations on Germany, crippling its economy and setting the stage for fascism. But to Du Bois, the decision by the victorious European powers to carve up Africa, Indochina, and the Middle East in open disregard for those who lived there was far more criminal. Self-determination, he saw, was only for white Americans and Euro-Americans. He would help convene a Pan-African Congress to protest the renewed subjugation of people of color. The war, Du Bois argued, had nothing to do with democracy and freedom. It was a struggle between imperial powers for the ability to plunder the dark world's wealth and toil, which is also, of course, what our wars in the Middle East are about. Du Bois knew, like Karl Marx, who he greatly admired, that the market economy was designed to make the weak weaker and the strong stronger. The idea that a class of black capitalists and entrepreneurs, or black politicians such as Barack Obama, would somehow rectify social and racial inequality, he said, was absurd. These tokens would serve the capitalist and imperialist system, which Du Bois said had to be overthrown and replaced with socialism. Outcasts are gifted, Du Bois wrote, with a second sight, or what he called a double consciousness. It was, he wrote in the souls of black folks, the sensation of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others. This gives to outcasts, as it did to many Jewish intellectuals in Nazi Germany, the ability to see behind what Du Bois called the veil. And this sight is imperative not only for the outcasts, but for the nation itself. Those blinded by privilege and the myth of whiteness cannot fathom reality or understand themselves without these outcasts. The more the voices of these outcasts are shut out, the more collective insanity grips the country. By silencing the voices of the oppressed, we ensure our own oppression. I have been in the world, Du Bois said, but not of it. I have seen the human drama from a veiled corner, where all the outer tragedy and comedy have reproduced themselves in microcosms within. From this inner torment of souls, the human scene without has interpreted itself to me in unusual and even illuminating ways. The endemic violence that plagues the country stuns many white elites, but this violence is a daily reality to Iraqis, Afghans, Yemenis, and of course, or people of color in America. But what on earth is whiteness that one should so desire it? Du Bois asked. Then, always, somehow, some way, silently, but clearly, I am given to understand that whiteness is the ownership of the earth forever and ever. Amen. It is curious to see America, the United States, looking on herself first as a sort of natural peacemaker, then as a moral protagonist in this terrible time, he wrote. No nation is less fitted for this role. For two or more centuries, America has marched proudly in the van of human hatred, making bonfires of human flesh and laughing at them hideously, and making the insulting of millions more than a matter of dislike, rather a great religion, a world war cry. Up, white, down, black, to your tents. O white folk, and world war with black and party-colored mongrel beasts. There comes a time, Du Bois wrote, when the oppressed erupt in rage, much like jihadists in the Middle East. Those who never took the time to investigate the long, slow drip of collective humiliation and suffering are shocked. The rage, because it appears to have no context or rationality, is seen as incomprehensible, the product of racial or religious mutations. We see this with the Israeli reaction to the nonviolent protests in Gaza. The press, little more than courtiers to the elites, dutifully certifies this rage as incomprehensible. And because it is incomprehensible, it must be violently crushed. It is difficult to let others see the full psychological meaning of caste segregation, he wrote. It is as though one looking out from a dark cave in a side of an impending mountain sees the world passing and speaks to it, speaks courteously and persuasively, showing them how these entombed souls are hindered in their natural movement, expression, and development. It gradually penetrates the minds of the prisoners that the people passing do not hear, that some thick sheet of invisible but horribly tangible plate glass is between them and the world. They get excited, they talk louder, they gesticulate, they may scream and hurl themselves against the barriers, hardly realizing in their bewilderment that they are screaming in a vacuum, unheard, and that their antics may actually seem funny to those outside looking in. They may even here and there break through in blood and disfigurement and find themselves faced by a horrified, implacable, and quite overwhelming mob of people frightened for their very own existence. Du Bois would hardly fare better today than he did a century ago. His radical critique of empire and capitalism would make him even more of a pariah in the academy and on the airwaves. The corporate state, assured they can keep us entranced with their electronic hallucinations and spectacles, along with the inane trivia and gossip that masquerades as news, do not see him or other radical theorists as a threat. They've orchestrated the post-literate society, the enforced ignorance that perpetuates their power. We have his books. Read them while you still can.
Journalist, activist, and author Chris Hedges. And you're listening to Notes from the Left Forum from a panel on W.E.B. Du Bois, what his life and work can teach us today. Next up, economics professor Richard Wolff, co-founder of Democracy at Work, which advocates for a transition to a worker co-op-based economy. He imagines an economic system without gradations of hierarchy. Here's Professor Wolff.
Capitalism has a problem. This, I assume, most of you have already noticed. But the particular problem of capitalism, or problems, if you like, could be summarized in the following two or three focal points. One, it's an extraordinarily unstable system. Wherever capitalism has settled, every 4 to 7 years it has an economic downturn. These have many names because they are so continuous. Downturns, recessions, depressions, business cycles, and I could go on. There are many names because we've all lived through them many times. It plunges the people who live in capitalism into unplannable catastrophes regularly recurring. Educations interrupted, lives destroyed, relationships abandoned, masses of people unemployed, huge numbers of businesses going out of business. The catastrophes, large and small, are part of capitalism. The second flaw, if you like, is the inequality, the relentless drive of capitalism to make a few people extraordinarily wealthy and the mass of people not so much. The Left Forum and other places documented not so long ago the work of a remarkable French socialist economist, Thomas Piketty, documenting, if you needed it, 600 pages about how capitalism everywhere and always drives to inequality and why so. Only interrupted if people rise up against it. And the third part of capitalism that's a flaw is that it divides people into employer and employee, replicating in a slightly altered way how previous economic systems divided people into master and slave and lord and serf. Now, the problem of capitalism is the catastrophe that instability, inequality, and employer-employee exploitation. The danger of capitalism is you can't have that system if the mass of people live in constant fear of it and experience it. And this has been a problem for every capitalism. And one of the solutions that almost all capitalisms have found, as Du Bois explained, is to arrange for a subpart, a portion of the working class, to bear a disproportionate burden of the instability, of the inequality, and of the exploitation. A part of the working class gets assigned the role, if you like, of shock absorber. The instability comes to them. They're the last hired and the first fired. The inequality comes to them. They're the bottom of the barrel. And the exploitation comes to them because they have the worst jobs demanded in a society. The reason you need a group like that is to stabilize the rest, to give them the illusion that it won't come to them. But of course, that won't work if it's just random. There has to be something about the designated group that will allow you to tell everybody else they're not the worst off, the victims of instability, inequality, and exploitation, because the system has to do that to somebody. No. They're the worst off because of some quality in them. They brought it on themselves. It's not a systemic necessity. So capitalism needs the other in psychological language, that other that the mass of people can think they are immune to the suffering of. The other can be a different color skin. Why not? A different ethnicity, a different religion, a different national origin. It really doesn't matter. As long as they can be held accountable for playing the role that capitalism assigns them and that capitalism needs to survive, as though it were their fault. An amazing maneuver, if you can pull it off, as modern capitalism did. And now the other way. For racism to survive, for the notion that there is something fundamentally different about, for example, black people as opposed to white people, an idea against which Du Bois' whole life was devoted, to sustain that fundamentally weird idea, capitalism was very helpful because capitalism assigns gradations, ranks. Capitalism is a system that has at the top a tiny group of people, the people who own the businesses, the board of directors that the owners select if you use the modern corporation as your model. And then below that a layer, and below that a layer, the top management, the middle management, the lower management, the better skilled workers, the middle skilled workers, the workers who have no skill at all, and the people who aren't really human. The system constantly drives it home. Which school you go to, which neighborhood you live in, how you dress, how you drive, where you're, everything, you're organized to understand rank. If you want to have an idea that racism matters, what you need is a system that teaches at every step the gradation. Black people are different. You know why you know that? Because they have no money. They're poor. They do the crappy work. They get paid crap. You can see it all around you. You reinforce the racism by the structure of capitalism, and you reinforce the capitalism by the racism that gives you the nice group upon whom to dump the costs of instability, inequality, and exploitation. Du Bois says, to defeat a system that's worked out this way, you need an alliance, a coalition, a partnership of anti-racism and anti-capitalism. I think Du Bois would have loved a slogan that I learned from the American feminist movement. The slogan went, "Women who seek equality with men lack ambition." I thought that was wonderful. And I think Mr. Du Bois would have loved to say, "Black people who seek equality with whites have the same problem." Why? Because the liberation of women requires the end of the capitalist system. Otherwise, they will become just exactly what it is they now recognize is nothing to aspire to. And the same applies to the race question. The trick is, how do you do it? How do you build the alliance that led the leader, intellectual and in many ways political, of African Americans to join a socialist party, to join a communist party, to make it crystal clear? And let's remember, when he joined the communist party at what you might argue was the height of the Cold War and of all the hysteria that went with it, he wanted everyone who knew about him, and there were many, to understand, I'm part of that. And my struggle is finished and fulfilled by me being, right when you think it'd be the last thing an activist on the African American community might do, no, I'm going to do exactly that. It's an understanding that there cannot be a transition from capitalism to something better that does not include the African American population. It's an unthinkable and unrealizable goal. And the liberation of Black Americans without the end of capitalism is the same mistake. Not available, not an option. You don't get rid of capitalism, it will recreate that racism that it has always been in partnership with. Not a conspiracy, it's the way this system has survived. If there isn't a racial minority to play the role, then there'll be an ethnic or a religious or an immigrant, fill in the blank. They all play the same. Inside a capitalist enterprise, we reproduce monarchy. We thought we overcame it when we cut off the heads of the Louis 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and so on. We didn't. The monarchy that was dead in politics just moved over into capitalist economy and found a new home, which we all take for granted. Now imagine a difference. Imagine an economic system in which the basic production of goods and services was done by people who had one person, one vote, making all those decisions. You can call it a collective, you can call it a commune, you can call it a worker co-op. There are lots of words. It doesn't matter. A decision to make production democratic. No gradations. Everybody gets paid in a collective decision of how we ought to do that in our community at this time. You are removing not just capitalism, but the reason for there to be an out-group, a group upon whom the disasters will be dumped to keep those in power at the top from being threatened by all the workers they depend on. You will have done away with that kind of inclusion, with the racial difference and the capitalist hierarchy. You will have built a population and a partnership that has a real chance. If Chris is right, and I think he is, that we are, in fact, in a period of extraordinary decline of capitalism, if what we are watching as Mr. Trump alienates every single European country there is, having already done that job with most of the rest of the world, if we see the divisions inside the United States, it's not hanging together. You can't do what has been done in the last period without a unified capitalist class, and they're not able to do that anymore. Then we have a chance, if we learn the lesson of Mr. Du Bois, because this splitting within capitalism, the divisions at home, the divisions internationally, they're scary, I know, we're all scared. But as always, Mr. Hegel's dialectic is never quiet. The scary danger is also an extraordinary opportunity. An anti-racist combined with anti-capitalist, for the reasons Du Bois helped us see, is a way forward that makes his work even more urgently appropriate for us to read. Thank you.
Economics professor Richard Wolff, co-founder of Democracy at Work. You've been listening to Notes from the Left Forum 2018, Chris Hedges and Richard Wolff on W.E.B. Du Bois, What His Life and Work Can Teach Us Today. This program was produced by Linda Perry of WBAI and Pacifica Radio, with thanks to the Left Forum, and thank you for listening.